Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.
Just as probation officer Alex Hastings seems to be finding herself professionally and personally, things could be about to get decidedly hot. Trouble could be stalking her under the big open skies of the Somerset Levels. An arsonist is threatening the tinder-dry landscape and all that eke out a living. Meanwhile, a sexual predator is readying himself to spring out of hiding. As if that is not enough for anyone to have on their plate, there are two spectres casting a shadow over Alex's workplace. A dreaded Home Office inspection is imminent, and it sends everyone into a shiver of anticipation and a scurry of activity. And rumours circle about the direction things could take following the arrival of a new boss.
Samuel was pleased with his new hideout. On his extensive exploration of the levels, he had found an old cottage, abandoned and almost derelict, down by the canal. Bushes had grown up around it, shielding it from the track that ran to the south, curving round the water meadows to link Western Zoylands to the main road. The door had been locked, and the grimy windows refused to budge, but a rickety gate opening into a small passageway leading to the back door was loose in its frame, secured only by some baling wire twisted round the door jamb. It was the work of a minute to untangle this, and push open the creaking back door. The smell made him screw up his face in disgust. It was rank inside the tiny kitchen, the stink coming from an old, rusty chest freezer in the middle of the room. Samuel held his breath and risked a look inside. It was empty, though the bottom was covered in a thick layer of brown sludge in which hundreds of dead flies were embedded. Slamming the lid shut in disgust, Samuel decided it would be easier to get rid of it than to try and clean it out. The thought of touching that revolting mess made his skin crawl. Leaving the adjoining door ajar, in case he had to leave in a hurry, he moved into the front room, the only other room on the ground floor. This was dusty, the cobwebs spanning the grimy ceiling a testament to the cottage's neglect. The only furniture was a battered armchair with a footstool, an upright chair shoved into one corner, and an old trestle table with some rather ominous-looking stains. It was considerably more acceptable than the kitchen, however, and Samuel decided, looking around carefully, that it would do rather well. He climbed the stairs in darkness, no light finding its way through the tiny, filthy window at the top of the stairs. A quick check around revealed a bedroom and two tiny box rooms, both covered in dust and draped with cobwebs. The bedroom looked as if it might have been used sometime in the last year or so, but whoever had slept there had not bothered much with proper bedding. The sagging mattress was draped in some old sacking and a few scraps of cloth, and there was no pillow. Samuel picked his way downstairs again, taking the stairs with great care. The last thing he needed was a bad fall, even possibly a broken ankle. The thought of lying in the gloom, helpless and unheeded, made him shudder. Despite the state of the cottage, he was pleased with his find. It was well hidden, obviously long abandoned, and a lot more substantial than any of his previous hides. Two usable rooms downstairs, once he dealt with the odious freezer, promised both shelter and privacy. It offered him a place to relax, plan, and be himself. It had been a long time since he'd had such luxury. It would be worth the effort to get the place cleaned up, he thought.
There is no smoke without fire, and it all adds up to a thriller out on the low flat lands. This is a vulnerable landscape, as we've seen on the news with the massive flooding over the last two or three wet winters. The people are equally vulnerable to change from forces beyond the wetlands. Through the four-book series, Jenny Finch has captured a way of life about to be cornered on all sides. The calm on the surface is already threatened through the motorway of grockles thundering past toward holiday destinations in the southwest. There are forces at work from government law and a hardening of attitudes leading to worrying reopening gulfs of intolerance. Will Alex and her new partner, Margie, fall foul? Are we heading towards a tumultuous climax for our cast as well as their fragile environment?
Steve also declined the chance to stay inside and get a free lunch. He was quite capable of getting his own free lunch and without being under the eye of his probation officer, so he scurried through the front door and set off into town to see what might be available. A lot of the smaller shops were closed up, he noticed. A few larger stores were trading, but they tended to have decent security. Steve preferred easier pickings, especially as he was now on his final chance with the magistrates. Getting nicked for shoplifting so soon after starting his probation order was a quick road to the Young Offenders Unit. His face was familiar to the few stallholders set up in the little market, and he hurried past, hands in his pockets, wearing a fine air of indifference. Time to branch out a bit, he thought. He had a new lighter in his pocket, but needed more fluid as well as something to eat. He wouldn't mind some ciggies either, but all the tobacco and stuff was kept behind a counter nowadays. It was next to impossible, luring a shopkeeper off the till on your own. Once more, he was missing his little stooges, especially Petey, who was back in the hostel, and not much the worse for his sunstroke. Charlie has always been a bit of a soft lad, though he would have been useful as a diversion, or even a patsy if things went wrong. But Charlie was a new man, full of big ideas and eager to change his life around. Charlie had even begun to influence Petey, and had been the first to volunteer for a day in the hostel kitchens. Steve snorted in derision as he walked out of the town centre and headed towards the Burnham Road. Off to one side was the local college, a sprawling collection of buildings with a ring of portable classrooms around the perimeter. A steady stream of students flowed through the main gate, and Steve decided to try his luck, slipping in through the wide-open doors and mixing with the flow of young people that milled around in a seemingly aimless fashion. The trick, he knew, was to look as if you belonged. Everyone else knew where they were going, with a lot of them heading to exams from the sound of the anxious chatter around him. That meant the corridors would empty soon, leaving a lone figure looking very out of place, and Steve had no idea of the layout. On a whim, he turned to the right, attracted by the sounds of a canteen, and his instincts proved correct when he passed the entrance to a good-sized dining hall. Fishing in his pocket, he dug out a few coins, enough for a cup of tea served in a heavy white beaker. Taking his drink, Steve positioned himself near the main door at a table that offered a clear view of the room. Students were so careless, he thought. They dumped their bags all over the place, spilling items on the floor or scattering their possessions across tables. Most of the stuff was junk, books and folders with pencil cases jumbled in, but a few had a Walkman sticking out of the side pockets of their bags. He could even see a couple of purses clearly visible and unattended. There were a decent number of people milling around, enough to cover his movements, and Steve picked out his target. A couple of girls sat at a table, deep in discussions over something boring. They were poring over a textbook, so Steve assumed they were doing some last-minute revision. Their bags were thrown down on an adjoining table, open to display two purses, a Walkman, and a rather nice-looking pen with what looked like a gold clip. Steve rose from his post and strolled over towards the toilets, brushing past the table and lifting a purse and the tape player without breaking stride. At the last minute, he turned and headed for the main door, annoyed at missing the pen in one of the purses. He was beginning to lose his touch.
Smoke and Adders is the fourth in the series of Jenny Finch crime novels, set under the endless skies of the Somerset Levels and in the endlessly challenging 1980s. But don't worry, this is one series where you can dip in at any time. Jenny is skilled at making you feel included and not excluded by the narrative. She certainly reels in the reader as the tension builds and the plot thickens. Mind you, before the end of the book, you are bound to feel a yearning to want to peer further back into the pasts of Alex and the characters that leap out of the levels and onto these pages. There are sinister undercurrents here as Jenny lifts the lid on what, to my mind, is one of the darkest decades of the 20th century, and that's saying something. But before you shake your head in disbelief at these 20th century attitudes, then perhaps look closer to home. There are surely uncomfortable parallels to some of the panic, prejudice, and hysterical intolerance of our own times.
Hi, this is Chase Masterson, founder of the Pop Culture Hero Coalition, the first ever organization to make a stand against bullying, racism, misogyny, LGBT bullying, cyberbullying, and other forms of hate using pop culture stories that we love. We all love superheroes. Why not be one? Check out our website at www.popcultureherocoalition.org. Follow us on Facebook at Pop Culture Hero Coalition and on Twitter at @SuperheroIRL. Thanks so much.
In today's crowded world, it's sometimes hard to get heard. And sometimes you need a little extra push to be heard. That's where Manila PR can help. We specialize in online radio and press for independent bands, with prices to match, and have been doing so for the last decade. So if you have a noise to make, make it with Manila. Visit manilapr.com now.
You're listening to Jenny Finch, crime writer, scholar, and commentator, with another classic book of the month on Southside Broadcasting. Crime writer. That means she authors the crimes. She's the mastermind behind the crimes. Oh, is this recording?
Yes, there we are. Filled in as though one of our directorial and indeed ace actors who occasionally voices new jingles and new idents. And if you're wondering why Jenny's voice was a little bit lower than normal, it was Rob Nichols who was anchoring the whole thing. And Rob, thank you for stepping into that. Obviously, usually a regular contributor to Book of the Month, and of course, Mr. Middlesbrough and coordinator Fly Me to the Moon, which we'll talk about as well. But thanks for, again, clearly from an ethical point of view, to have an author to review their own book.
Yeah.
It's going to be challenging from so many ways. But welcome to yourself, and also Reverend Marie Edwards.
Great
stuff there. And in Barcelona, because that's where he is, William Coles is with us. How are you, William?
Very good, Shane. Thank you. How are you?
Very good. And I know Rob was looking sort of slightly. You thought we got Jenny online, didn't you, for a moment there? You thought we were going to have a sort of spoof thing on that basis. No. We as if we could do that to Jenny Finch from that perspective. William, of course, you also had your book featured and reviewed on Book of the Month. And I believe, Rob, that Mr. Tuba
instantly became a bestseller.
There you have it.
No.
Rob is still looking for a copy of Mr. Two-Bomb for his brother, I believe.
No. I ordered one.
You got it?
Yeah, I did.
So there we are. He's ordered it. Was your brother happy?
Very happy, because he lived in Japan for a long time, and we've both visited that part of Japan, so it's an incredible story, yeah.
And as I say, it's nice to keep the Book of the Month on its international theme, because next time around we end up in Blackpool, but William is currently in Barcelona. Whereabouts in Barcelona are you, William?
In the hills, looking down. My wife wants to go up to galleries and such like this afternoon, and I want to take the children to the theme park. We're deciding who will win this one.
And of course, you know, proving consummate professionalism that you are, and indeed resident of Edinburgh, now that having a brief sojourn in Barcelona, you have had a copy of Jenny Finch's Smoke and Adders. Share with us your thoughts on what you made of this, the fourth in the Alex Hastings quadrilogy.
It's the quartet. Yes, it's a fantastic book, a real triumph. I'm surprised that Somerset hasn't sort of signed her up, the Somerset Tourist Board, to get people to go down there, because I haven't been there for ages, but having read it, I'm thinking, yeah, I should get back there. It is a terrific story, really bowls along, and we can't get too much into the story, otherwise that would spoil it all, but you've got an arsonist, you've got a sex pest, and it is a real page-turner. One thing caught my eye, which I've never seen before in a book, and that was at the end, when Jenny fesses up. Because obviously in novels, particularly crime ones, you generally have the writer mixing up fact and fiction and stuff that they have made up. And then at the end, Jenny confesses to everything that is true, and everything she says, everything else is fantasy. So she's saying that thirst. Interviews are real. Section 28 is real. The pub DJ is real. And then she says that apparently the gory bits, they're all made up. We should have left it at that. We should have just, let the reader decide what's real and what's not.
Reverend Marie Edwards, wearing either your hat as full-time chaplaincy leader or indeed reader. I mean, I know when I sent you the book and you said, oh, I might not get through it in time, etc., but would you echo what William was saying there in terms of a page-turner?
I would, absolutely. That's one of the reasons I have been able to get through it, because I couldn't put it down. It was just really good. It flowed really well and it just kept you intrigued from start to finish. There was nothing in it that wasn't relevant. There was no kind of bits that you thought, why has she put that in or anything like that. It all fitted together lovely. It was a great book.
Sometimes, technically, when people graduate from a writing class, there's almost a sort of notion that you can see the technicist at work and you can say, oh, yeah, they dropped that in. I don't get that sense with Jenny. I get the sense that actually everything connects, but in a nice, organic way.
Yeah.
You know, you do sort of see the characters that emerge. They are well-drawn characters. Again, I was a great fan of Ada. I think she rocks, you know. Yeah. Mind you, having said that, I think Pongo the Goat, for me, is well up there in terms of serious scenarios. Rob, obviously, you did the review. Your thoughts from yourself? Would you echo what...
Oh, definitely, yeah, absolutely. It was hard to put it down, and there is a fire that rages through the whole book, put it that way.
See what you did there? Very good. Of course, we said it was the fourth in the Alex Hastings series, but not a major plot reveal here. I gather that as she's heading north, we might well see echoes of a certain place not too far away from where the studio is in Middlesbrough occurring in Saltburn.
Sticking to the S's then.
This was a thought. Because clearly, William, all your books have actually been separate, they've been complete and they've been wonderful in their own sort of sense, and even, let's do some shameless plugs here, your latest two classics that are actually revealed on the internet. Would you like to share their names, please?
The Princess in the Golden Cage and The Geek Who Learned to Charm. Not that that was remotely based on you, Alex.
The Geek Who Learns to Charm. Do you know, when I read that whole thing through, But in terms of that, would you be ever tempted, William, to actually return and produce, as indeed Jenny is doing, you know, the ongoing series of any of the characters that you've worked with?
Maybe. Maybe. I'd never say never. Look, if I got an international bestseller with any one of these ones and it was turned into a film, the rule is I'd turn out a sequel, even with the Lord Lucan book, and I didn't quite kill him off, and so I could definitely bring him back with no legs.
Right. Oh. A line from that. Of course, if you want heavy political satire, go for Dave Cameron's School Days. It's frighteningly close to life and reality, really. In fact, I'm amazed Boris Johnson hasn't been contacting you to actually say, so what do I do now then, William? It's amazing.
Yes, maybe I could. Yes, I could definitely do a sequel to that one. Yeah, all I'm waiting for is some traction. Yeah, as soon as you've got million sales, then you definitely do the sequel, and that's what I'm waiting for.
It's like Helen Fielding and Bridget Jones, etc. Yeah. Why didn't you just leave it with one? Who knows? Anyway, that's sequels and so on. I mean, Rob, other sort of comments with respect to the book? I mean, you mentioned obviously the hard-hitting political notion there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, maybe I was fortunate. Some of the issues that were being talked about there, which you also say maybe we need to be careful that they don't re-emerge again.
I'm maybe fortunate like you, actually, Alex. I wasn't aware of people being dismissed from jobs and totally, yeah. So I don't know whether it was whether we were lucky in the area of the country we were living in, because it could have been a regional thing. But yes, I feel there's, you look back and think it's quite horrendous, but then think, well, there was quite a lot of parallels to things that have happened this year with regard to intolerance and things that you wouldn't have dreamt in the 80s that would be the reality now.
Clearly you were one of the Sun's finest reporters from the perspective of investigation, but you were based in Washington in the 90s, William. I mean, were you in the 80s, from your own look back at the time, was this something which kind of resonated as a sort of, well, you know, people were talking about Section 28, Clause 28 and other sort of issues that were there. I mean, if you talk about, I'd probably say, well, I remember the miners' strikes, I remember the Nottingham sort of battles, etc. Clearly there was a certain thing at Wapping that was lots of fun for certain sort of folk, etc. But I mean, your thoughts in terms of the representation of the time, William?
Yeah, it was delicious how it all came back to me. I hadn't I mean, I'd been aware of it, but hadn't really thought about it. And then suddenly you're right back there in the sort of late 80s. And, yes, it all comes back. She must have done her homework on it. I mean, it's way more than just recollection. She's done a lot of research, too, to get it just spot on.
Marie, rather like William, Rob and myself, even though to look at you, you would never believe that you could have been around in the 80s at all from that sort of particular side of things. Thoughts from yourself, looking back, you know, 4 decades or 3.5 decades or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think things have definitely changed. I think people's tolerances have changed over the years, some for the better and some not. Mm. And I think Rob's right when he says, although the situations have changed and sometimes people's perceptions of differences and changes are still the same in some respects. People are still ruled by fear of the unknown and fear of change for themselves and what that means for themselves, and you know, trying to protect their own and their own families and their own livelihoods and things. And so they sort of turn those fears and angers out over to what's different and what they don't know. And yeah, that still goes on today, unfortunately.
Something that William and Rob, I think, sort of addressed were, you know, villains were really nasty, and without spoilers and so on, it's interesting to see the way you got the description of that. But at the same time, there were also lots of tales of the lad who kind of managed to make it and end up actually being a stonemason and sort of works on that basis. And that, you know, in a sense, it's part of a human routine. And that's, again, William, from your own perspective, in terms of the modern parables that you put together with respect to the geek who loved to charm and the princess, etc. I mean, writing that, did you feel it also worked then, saying that actually there is an underlying positivity that despite all the garbage that sometimes people are faced with, you can still emerge in a positive sense?
Oh yeah, of course. Our hero, Alex Hastings, I mean, she's an optimist, and although all this, well, in every novel really, the hero has to have challenges, and she comes out smiling. It's a tough old time for her, but yeah, she comes shining through. This is how all stories have to work, isn't it?
Well, we like to think so. I mean, I don't know,
Rob. Absolutely.
Rob, you've read some of the early work, and of course, let's mention The Mothman, The Drowners, and Death of the Elverman. How do you think this compares in terms of the quartet?
I think this is my favourite of the four, which is good, really, isn't it? To be, and that is, you know, if you look at films, obviously, often the sequels not up to. So I'm very much looking forward to what happens next, if something happens next, which is what you should be left with in that situation, shouldn't you? And if she is going to make a big geographical leap, that'd be quite interesting, because it'd be a very, very different setting. Because I think the great thing for me about one of the great things about these books is that the environment and the landscape plays a starring role through all the books, doesn't it? And the fact that
we've got some decent landscape on the northeast.
Yeah, oh yeah, not
absolutely. Head north, William. Head north. you're in Edinburgh. It's all good.
But also the fact that we've while we've been reading these books, there's the Somerset Levels has been on the news so much for the floods that have happened, for maybe a part of the country that people weren't aware of before that, and it's interesting because it brings out just how vulnerable that area is, and how vulnerable that way of life was, and she's captured it, hasn't she, at a time when it was facing quite a lot of challenges.
Okay, let's sort of play not devil's advocate here, but sort of adjust this, and William raised the sort of notion of bestsellers, etc. I felt that the whole text, all four texts actually have a cinematic televisual quality to them. So William, allowing for that, and if you agree, who would you actually like to see as the lead as Alex Hastings? If you had a casting magic wand and you said, you know, you could actually say at this moment in time, Jenny Finch, William Coles.
Exactly who it is.
Yes.
I know exactly who it is. It's the woman from The Night Manager. Not the sort of model one. Is it Coleman? She's in her 40s.
Make sure you repeat.
And she was the spook in The Night Manager.
Right.
Isabel Coleman? Might be. Yeah, anyway.
Okay, we'll look that up. set our Google sort of trends and aspects to work with respect to that one. But I imagine.
Yeah, she's brilliant, actually. She's the one. Okay, get her. In fact, send her the books. Get her on side, and then she will use her powers to get the TV made.
Yeah. I'll be looking up Night Manager. You see, this is connectivity in every sense of the word. Rob, any questions you want to put to William about The Princess and the Golden Cage, The Geek Who Lurked to Charm, or indeed Mr. Two-Bomb, or any of the other marvellous things that he's put together?
Yes, William, Mr. Two-Bomb, did you? I went to Japan and went to the temple site and Hiroshima in the same day.
You've been to the whole lot.
I haven't been to Nagasaki, but I've been to
Wow. The problem obviously is that the whole place was destroyed, so it's rather difficult to conjure up what it was like 75 years ago. I did the best I could, but predominantly I had to read tons of books for it. I thought that would be the best way forward. But anyway, glad you like it. Yeah.
Oh, very much. Yeah. And I like the way that you said that he saw himself as the luckiest man in the world, and many would say he was the unluckiest. It's incredible the way that his outlook. And he has a mission. He has a mission, doesn't he? From then on.
My brother-in-law is the Times Asia editor, and he lives in Japan, and he interviewed one of the few guys who had survived both atomic bombs, and the guy was in his 90s, the last one to be alive. He died about 2 years ago, and so he asked him this question: do you feel lucky or unlucky to have survived the bombs? And the guy says, God, everyone asked me that.
Well, at least you're being consistent. I think Olivia Colman is the lady who's cropping up in terms of
Olivia Colman, there we go. Yes.
Sorted.
Yeah. Ah.
It's the magic of those routines, you know. We don't want to leave the listener hanging if we can help
Olivia Colman, yes, she's going to be Alex Hastings. And it's, of course, it's the 950th anniversary today of the battle.
You see? He might have been listening to the show earlier.
Yes.
You see that connection there? This is the sort of celebration and planning that we put in to have the fourth in the Alex Hastings series on the 950th anniversary of the battle itself. The last time Britain was ever successfully invaded. People have tried since, obviously. Partially Germans. But, you know, ultimately, we're still here. And have emerged, etc. And, of course, all sorts of other fine folk happening as well. Final plug for the Alex Hastings series of novels that are actually there. The Mothman, The Drowners, and Death of the Elven Man are also still available. But the one we've been actually working on today is Smoke and Adders. I know it sounds criminal to do this, but it's the marks out of 10 moment. So, Rob, mark out of 10 for yourself for Jenny Finch's Smoke and Adders.
9 out of 10.
Marie?
I would agree with that, yeah. 9 out of 10.
9 out of 10. William?
I'm giving it a 10. They're being a bit miserable.
I was thinking I was going to be sort of seen as a slightly sort of deck, and I'm going 9.5. But well done in all sorts of the weather. Classic stuff from that point of view. And I think Jenny will be back with us in the not-too-distant future. So that's it for us. We've got a Fly Me to the Moon, I believe, also coming together. William, are you able to stick online from Barcelona? I mean, or is it a case of, do we say happy trails now? It's entirely up to yourself.
I have not been able to find a computer, tragically.
It's okay. You've been summoned. So tragically, we won't be asking you for any comments on the Watford game or anything else from that sort of perspective. You know, it could
it's
happen.
A load of old rubbish!
There we are. But thank you once again for joining us on the Book of the Month. A pleasure as ever. I think the next one, we're hopefully heading off to Blackpool for the Bridge of the Starship Enterprise for an event there. So that's all good news. And then, of course, we've still got Christine Webber novel to actually sort of work through the system. So those are upcoming Books of the Month. We'll talk to our executive producer, Jenny, about that as well. I'm sure she'll sort it out from that point of view. That's it. Thanks for your time. You've been listening to Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting, or as we like to say...
Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.